Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. It's nice to see so many people here on a gorgeous fall day. My name is Kathy Mercier, and I am the director of the Center for the Study of Children's Literature at Simmons College. And Simmons has the distinct pleasure of sponsoring this afternoon's session. We are delighted to be here as a sponsor of the 5th Annual Boston Book Festival. The Boston Book Festival. Yay! The Boston Book Festival has truly transformed how this city thinks about itself as a community of readers, a community of writers, and a community of creative people. So I'm delighted that you are able to come to this first Friday afternoon session that launches our weekend of productions around children's literature. Today, this afternoon, I'm going to first introduce Megan Lambert. Megan is the moderator for this afternoon's panel. Megan is currently on the faculty at the Center for the Study of Children's Literature at Simmons College. We are beyond delighted to have her on our teaching staff. Megan teaches critical theory and the picture book. Megan also has worked for a number of years at the Eric Carle Museum and at the Carle Museum of Picture Book Art. Megan developed, beyond her master's thesis project, a way of working with picture books and children called the whole book approach. And you'll hear more about that when that publication comes out sometime in the next year.
July.
Megan.
Thank you, Kathy. So I'm delighted to be here on behalf of the Center for the Study of Children's Literature at Simmons to be part of a conversation with four authors of some of my favorite books for young readers. The way that this afternoon's session is going to go is that I'm going to introduce each speaker, and then they will each give a little talk about their books. And I'm going to then ask them a few questions so that we can have a conversation on stage, and then you'll get a chance to ask them questions, too, at the very end. We're really hoping that a lot of children will speak up and ask questions of these authors. So now let's meet the medalists. Jack Gantos is a children's... is a children's and young adult author whose best-known characters include Rotten Ralph and Joey Pigza, and I would add to that Jack Gantos. Two books from the Joey Pigza series, Joey Pigza Swallowed the Key and Joey Pigza Loses Control, have been a National Book Award finalist and a Newbery Honor Book, respectively. And his newest book, From Norvelt to Nowhere, is a sequel to the Newbery Medal-winning Dead End in Norvelt. Lois Lowry, unfortunately, is unable to be with us today, and we're sorry for her absence. She's sorry for her absence, but I know that I speak for lots of folks in the room in adoring her books. I grew up especially on the Anastasia series, which took place right in Cambridge. Rebecca Stead is the author of children's and young adult books.
There you go.
Including the 2010 Newbery Medal winning When You Reach Me. And she also, her first book was called First Light, and her most recent book is called Liar and Spy, which was released in August 2012, and which I just read this past weekend and thought was wonderful. How many people here have had a chance to read Liar and Spy yet? Okay, terrific. If you haven't, absolutely pick it up. And she's currently working on a new book for middle grade readers. And Kate DiCamillo. Is an author of children's books of all levels, two of which, The Tale of Despero and Because of Winn-Dixie, have been adapted into films. The Tale of Despero was awarded a Newbery Medal, and Because of Winn-Dixie was a 2000 Josette Frank Award winner and a 2001 Newbery Honor Book. Her most recent book is Flora and Ulysses, which I also read this past weekend. That was kind of my homework, was catching up on our speakers' books, which is also wonderful. How many of you have read Flora and Ulysses yet? It's newer, so I hope you'll all get a chance to check that one out as well. And now, like I said, we're going to turn things over, and each writer is going to talk a bit about their work, and then we'll move into the questions. And first, we have Jack Gantos.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, let me put this here. The clock is ticking, so I'm going to have to speak quickly. First off, it's very nice to be here. It's sort of like being in a living picture book, isn't it? You can follow right along and just make up the words. I started writing picture books in Boston. I came to Boston to write. I went to Emerson College, and I wrote the first book. That's not how I looked when I came here. But this book I wrote across the street over in Bates Hall. And when I moved here, I moved into a rooming house on Marlborough Street. And in those days, in the 70s, you could get a cheap room and a good house with nice people. And I did just that. And I was one of those people that liked cats. And so I got a cat. I got Ralph. I got him used out of the Boston Globe. He was a Harvard University cat. And so I got him, and he was pretty much a hellion. And pardon me. And and so then I just wrote that book. And Sarah's pretty much my older sister. I'm pretty much Ralph. And then my sister had a journal. This is really where I got started writing, in journals and diaries. And she had a journal, and I was a copycat, so I got one too. But then I didn't know what to do with it, which most people don't. This is years later, but forget about that. In the early days, those would have been blank pages, a lot of them. And then I started getting a little older, and I was like, well, what am I going to do? So I read a great book. That's what I did. I was a library kid. Now, you all remember Harriet the Spy, which this book by Louise Fitzhugh, just like, this is the only book you have to read. And you get this and a journal or a diary, and then you've got it all. It's like a handbook on how to find content. Peek into people's windows, overhear everybody's conversations, write it down, you know, stretch the truth. Doesn't matter. And so I started practicing Harriet the Spy stuff, and I started spying on all my neighbors. And I loved that. I loved, you know, like just understanding everybody's life around me. And it was really the first time that I realized that the life you're living is what you need to be writing about. And that kind of empty-headed approach where you stare at a blank sheet of paper and you say, well, nothing interesting ever happens to me. Really, what you need to do is just walk outside and find the people that live in the low-supervision family house and and hang out with them for a while. And, you know, build your own electric chair and do things like that. We made a Roman catapult. We used to shoot each other across the pagoda's front yard. It was good. We used to ride our bikes right off of the roof, right down and into the swimming pool. It was kind of like that Jackass show they show, you know, where people are just like smacking themselves silly in the head and splitting up blood, teeth. But it was good for writing. And then I moved in on my family. It just seemed to me that your family, everybody comes to some sort of age where they think their family is really unusual. And it's true. So if you just actually just make a map of your house and start putting down where everything interesting happens, you're going to come up with a tremendous amount of stuff. So you have your personal history, your neighborhood history, your family history. And so then I started writing it all down. There I am. It's such a smarmy look. And it's, you know, it's one of those pictures where you still say to yourself, I was dressed by my mother, you know, even then. And then we moved a lot, and I would, draw, like, this is Barbados. We lived in Barbados, and I would draw the island, and I would put down where everything interesting happened. My mother was arrested for murder, where that little pistol is, and we had headless chicken races, because you couldn't, you know, like, buy chickens in a grocery store. You had to buy live ones, and then cut their heads off, and chase them around the neighborhood, because they run without a head. It's fabulous, really, it is. And the blood squirts out with the heartbeat, and... Never
is that your next
that.
Picture book?
It would. I think it would make a good one.
The headless chicken race.
The cockfights was pretty good, though. That was we had a fighting chicken and had a trainer, of all things, you know, passed out one day and put the whole chicken mouth in his chicken head in his mouth and sucked the blood out of its eyeballs and then spit it out, and the chicken revived. It was. I was like, how do you do that?
Him the last That
was kind of a job I wanted for a while. And then I started trying to, kind of organize my thoughts. Because, you get all of these thoughts, and then you have absolutely no sense of structure, organization, what comes first, what comes second. And so I would work on those little patterns, Oh, Joey. There was always a Joey in my class. These were my favorite kids. I went to 10 schools in 12 grades. There was always a Joey Pigs in my class. And he was always the friendliest kid in the class because he had burned out every other kid in the class. And then I was like new meat on the bone. And then, finally here. How am I doing on time? One. Okay, ready? Go. Okay, Norvelt, it's a real town. We love Eleanor Roosevelt. We call her St. Eleanor. That's my grandfather. 50 years later, that's me. I mean, that's pretty amazing. Norvelt's a town built for out-of-work coal miners and farmers. And then on those shoulders, poof, I get to run around like a goofball. And then that's our garage. That's the backyard. That's where I fired off my dad's sniper rifle. And that's what I was shooting for. That's my bloody nose. I get bloody noses all the time. That's for my journal. This is my bedroom. Don't confuse it with a nunnery, but it is. My mother was a very neat and tidy person. These are the books I was reading as a kid, all 250 landmark books. And you begin to question history. Guadalcanal Diary, you're very proud. Proud. Crusades, you're confused. They can't take Jerusalem. So then they send all the children over who are cut the ribbons. And they all go to heaven, sorry. And you're like, no, they don't. They died on the beach. And then this is where you learn how to empathize with the victims. We're bombing from the top. They're burning. 100,000 of them are burning down below. How do you feel as a kid when you read stuff like that? So you begin to question history. There's my dad, of course. He was heroic. There's my mother, cooking the baby. And there's Soylent Green. And then her garden. And then fortunately the phone rang. And at any rate, I went down to Miss Volker's house, and she started teaching me a lot about history by writing obituaries and matching them with this day in history stuff. And she would be annoyed by Catholics and Protestants had two different cemeteries. And if you were intermarried in faith, you had to get the wall. You had to get the plots close to the wall so you could reach across even in death. That just didn't seem right. I did needlepoint. And then Mr. Spiz, and then we had Hell's Angels. I was trying to get everything in this book, including another bloody nose. And then all my old typewriters, I loved them. Girl Scouts, who doesn't love a good Girl Scout? Or the cookies. And then the horse. And then there's my dad. He made me mow down my mother's garden because he built a runway in our backyard for this J3 he built. And then I kept reading. I love this. My dad made me build a fallout shelter. Because they showed us those movies. Remember those movies in school? Right, fake towns. Boom. Then they drop a bomb on it. Boom. And that's what's left. And then you're a kid like, holy cow. I think I'll just walk out and catch the bomb. And then, fortunately, then Miss Volker made me drive, dress up as the Grim Reaper, showed up at people's houses, scared them to death. And this is Norvelt. And after that, that's dead end. Is that fast or what? Telephone rang. And I think somebody said, you're finished on the other end. Thank you very much.
Oh, my God. I've got your back.
And now Rebecca.
Yes.
Woo. My heart is racing.
Ask if you can use his voice.
Yeah, I kind of want to give Jack my time, and I bet you all wish I would do that too. But I'm not going to, because I think Megan would be mad.
Maybe a little.
So I am just going to talk to you without pictures, and I thought that what I would talk about is just really just a short little bit about why I'm a writer and also how I write. And, You know, it's pretty simple. The reason why I'm a writer is because of what books sort of did to me or did for me when I was a kid, and what they continue to do for me now. So I read a whole lot as a kid. I read every kind of book that I could get my hands on. I was an only child. I was actually an only child of divorce. And I have completely terrific parents, though. So it wasn't really sad, but I did have a lot of time alone or, you know, one-on-one with an adult. And I began to feel a certain way with books. I began to feel like I was experiencing something that was real and that was sometimes more authentic almost than what was going on in my daily life. Because in books, people talked about what was going on inside. And mostly when you're 10 or 11 or 12, at least for me, that discussion about emotion and internal life and feelings and kind of the weird thoughts that I'm having all the time, I have to assume that at least some of you were walking around having kind of what I call weird thoughts. To me, weird thoughts are just, you know, funny observations or the weird way that you look at the tiles on your bathroom floor and the sort of secret patterns that you make out of them and, you know, things that you don't talk about, you know, about with other people. Those are the kinds of things that I discovered in books. And it sort of planted a seed in me, all of that reading, and that when that seed sprouted, which took a long time. I didn't write as a kid at all. I didn't want to write really until much later in my life, until my 30s. But when I was a kid, I was experiencing something that many years later would make me want to write, but which did not make me actually brave enough to write. So that's the second thing I want to talk about, which is sort of being brave enough to write. And there are actually a couple of brave things about writing, or ways you have to be brave. First of all, there's this sort of simple challenge, which is, you know, to look at yourself and to think, you know, I could be a working writer, was something that was incredibly hard for me. And I actually recently read in an interview of another writer that she didn't publish her first story till she was in her 40s. And the reason was, even though she wanted to write and she thought about words all the time, she thought that if she could be a working writer like all those other working writers, then when she looked in the mirror, she would see the word writer across sort of written across her forehead in the mirror. And it sounds absurd, but that's actually a little bit the way I felt. I thought that if I were meant to be a writer, I don't know, a teacher would say to me, you know, Rebecca, you must write. You're so gifted. That did not happen. Or, you know, that I would get some kind of sign like, you know, like Harry Potter's letter. He got a letter. People, you know, telling them, this is your destiny, and this is sort of the answer to all of your secret longing. And so I had the secret longing. I finally figured out what it was, but it took me a long time to start putting words on paper. And that is where the second kind of bravery for me comes in, because Kate and I were actually sort of joking in the back about she kept threatening to ask me about the book I'm working on now. How's that book going? And I kept giving her dirty looks and saying, you better not ask me that, or I'm going to give you a really mean look. And that is because, for me, the process of writing is really, and for a lot of my friends, is really difficult and is really challenging and is really no different from the experience that I had when I was 10 years old and I was sent home to write a story and I just had nothing to work with. Sometimes the way I feel is that, you know, I'm in a room with nothing, just me alone in a room, and the door is closed, and someone says, okay, we want a pair of really nice, you know, boots in 3 months. And I'm thinking, I don't have anything in here. How am I supposed to make a pair of boots? That kind of is my experience of writing. I often feel like I don't have anything, and that when I put words on the paper, I feel that there's nothing there, and it takes a long time for me to sort of... I work on things for a very long time, which is why there's so much time between my books. And mostly what I'm doing is sort of layering and thinking and rethinking to sort of... And getting over that hump of disappointment that comes from writing a first draft. You know, you finally are putting words down, and you sort of can't believe how disappointed you are by those words. Are you nodding, Kate? Do you ever feel
nodding.
That way?
It's like that wonderful thing that Aunt Patchett wrote about the minute you put the first word of the beautiful novel in your head down on paper. You've compromised your vision.
Yes.
You know, and
it's immediately compromised.
Yeah, and so as a writer, you have to live with disappointment because it's never the beautiful thing that's in your head.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is sort of, I think, the second sort of most important thing that there is to know about writing and that there is to know about my process is that, you know, it's sort of that, just what you said. It's a long process of overcoming what feels disappointing until finally there are, you know, moments of happiness toward the end.
So are you not, are you disappointed in the end product then?
No. No, I've gotten used to it.
But aren't you proud when you hold that book in your
hand? Yeah, I do feel proud finally.
Yeah.
I do. So I'm not... I probably, you know, after Jack, that was like a total downer. But I'm it's a hopeful, Jack's going to cry. It's a hopeful message at the end, because I think what I'm saying is that it's a humble process, but finally at the end, an incredibly rewarding one for me. I get to sit up here between Kate and Jack.
I think you've been influenced by the space.
I've been influenced by
it. But it's worth it in the end.
All right, Kate's turn.
Is it? I didn't see him holding up the numbers.
He was doing
or
this.
Oh, was he? Wrap it up? Wow. That was great.
Yeah.
Okay,
nice.
Thank you.
Nice.
So I'm trying to take my cues from these two, and I'm just going to piggyback off of both of you. I came from a single-parent home, which I've found out in retrospect is great if you want to write. And also, I was sick all the time. So I missed just a ton of school. And I fortunately had a mother who read to me, purchased books for me, and took me to the library all the time. So when I was home alone all the time, we did not have a TV. And that was very distressing to me. At one point, as a sidebar, my brother and I went up and down the street asking if we could watch other people's TVs. And we were found out and, you know, pulled back. So, but since there was no TV and since my mother read to me all the time and since the house was filled with books, when I was home alone all day, I would read. And for me, stories were a huge comfort, and they helped me make sense out of the world. And so I never... ever when I was a kid thought, oh, I want to be a writer, because I don't know, I just thought books weren't produced by human beings,
right?
You know, they were so fabulous, I didn't think it had anything to do with human endeavor. And you know, and do y'all go in and do school visits?
Yeah.
I always think if anybody gets any message from me coming in and talking to them, it's just like, if this is something that human beings do, I am a big mess, but yet you can tell a story, and you can make sense out of things. So how am I doing with the time? Am I done yet? Okay. So then I grow up, and I go to school, and I major in English. What else am I going to major in? Because I love to read, and you're given those... You give it a syllabus, and it's got 40 books on it that you have to use your parents' money to buy, and it's just like it's the happiest thing ever. So it's just like... And occasionally an adult would say, what are you going to do with an English degree? And I'm like... You know, I ignored them. And then I had this wonderful professor who said to me, and this is a direct quote, You have a certain facility with words you should consider graduate school. And that's what he said to me, but I thought he was trying to tell me something else entirely, which is that I was incredibly talented. And so I thought, why bother with graduate school? I'll just be a writer. And so I took my mother's JCPenney credit card and I purchased black turtlenecks instead of going to graduate school. And then I wore the black turtlenecks and I sat around looking bored and disdainful. And everybody would go, oh, that's Kate, she writes. And it was great. It was a great gig because I wasn't writing, but everybody said that I was writing. And I told everybody that I was a writer and I read a lot of books on writing. And then when I was 30 years old, I had this sudden realization that I was not going to be a writer unless I wrote something. So it was great. It was like my eyes were open. And at the same time, I moved. I grew up in Central Florida. I moved from Central Florida to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I got a job in a book warehouse. I was assigned to the third floor as a picker, which meant I went around literally picking the books off the shelves. And the third floor is where all the kids' books were. And there's only a certain amount of time that I, as a reader, could go around picking books off the shelf before I started to read them on the clock. Yes. Yes. But I was a really good picker. I could pick really fast. I would get my work done, and then I would stand in the warehouse and read. And the first novel that I read that had been written for kids since I was a kid, The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963. And I remember exactly where I was standing in the warehouse when I read that, and I thought, I want to try and do something like this. And I went from there to Bridge to Terabithia, which I was not quite, we didn't get that as kids. So, and then Letters from Rivka, and I just read my way through the whole third floor of the warehouse. It was a free education. And I knew what I wanted to do. So how am I doing on time now? 3 minutes. Okay. And so here I am. So, yeah, so I started to do the work, and I made a deal with myself that I was going to do 2 pages a day. And that's still the deal. And so I would write before I went into the warehouse in the morning. And I think I can tell you about one of the gentlemen that I worked with in the warehouse. I think I have enough time for that. His name was Gary. I don't know where he is now. He was always waiting for me at the time clock when I came into the book warehouse. And he would always say the same thing to me. Do you think that Dickens wrote 2 pages a day? And it was so enraging to have him ask me that question. But he wasn't quite done. Then he would say, what's plan B, babe? What's plan B for when the writing doesn't work out? And so by this time, I was incandescent with rage. And the rage would last until 4:30 the next morning when it was time for me to get up and write the 2 pages. So big thank you to Gary. Did that kill 3 minutes? I have 1 minute. I'd like to say thank you for laughing at anything that I've said, and I'm glad to be here. Yeah. Okay. Good. I'm done. Yay! That's it didn't have any visuals, but, you know. No. Now we can go, oh, you're going to ask me questions, and then they will.
So now we're going to have a discussion up here for a little bit. I'll prompt it with a little bit of a story and a question as well. And you all can just take it and use it as you will. And then afterwards, we'll turn it over to kids in the audience who'd like to ask a question of their own. So while Rebecca was speaking, and she was talking about that challenge of facing the blank page. She described it as sitting in that empty room and she has to make a pair of boots and she doesn't have anything to make it with. And it made me think of a fairy tale. It made me think of Rumpelstiltskin,
yeah,
of the Miller's daughter sitting in this empty room needing to spin straw into gold. Not exactly perfect, but it made me think of that. And Rumpelstiltskin at its center has that question of guessing a name. When I was a kid and I was reading, I loved characters' names. I would just underline the ones that I adored. I loved what Anne of Green Gables said about her name, that it really mattered that it was Anne with an E. And she took issue with that whole question of what's in a name. A rose would smell as sweet with any other name. I just botched the quotation, but you know what I mean. And I appreciated that Anne said that because I loved the power of a name. What's in a name? A whole story can be. And this weekend, I was in New Hampshire, And I was standing in a post office getting ready to send postcards out. And I was reading this plaque on the wall, and it was a commemorative plaque honoring soldiers who'd served in different wars in our country's history. And my eyes just latched on to one name on the list, and that name was Hercules Mooney.
Wow.
And I thought, what a fantastic name. Yeah. That sounds like a name out of some kind of story. And so in my mind, I started spinning different stories. Who the heck is Hercules Mooney, and what is he doing? And so I thought, since we had these writers on stage, we could ask them to do something with that name.
Jack will do that? Yeah.
Because if we think about their books, names are important in their books. When I was reading Norvelt, we know that the town of Norvelt got its name. I know how Sam in Lois Lowry's books got his name in the Anastasia series, and I also know the name that his sister did not give him. Does anyone know what Anastasia was going to name Sam? No. Look it up. It's very funny. I know how Ulysses the squirrel got his name. Do you know what Sam's name was going to be, Jack? Were you just nodding?
No.
It's a good one.
Obviously a teacher.
And then I know from reading Rebecca's books how Safer and Pigeon and Candy all got their names. This ends up being so important in terms of character development. So it's important to you all, too, in your writing. I know that from your book. So what would you do with Hercules Mooney? Or can you use that question of what's in a name to talk about character development or setting in your books?
Oh, you gave me an out. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
I appreciate that. I was thinking that must be an out character from, you know, like a Ulysses from Ulysses, you know, Hercules Mooney.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, he's got to be a bartender, don't you think? You know? But when I visit my mom in Western Pennsylvania, she doesn't drive, and so I always get her right in the car. And we drive to her favorite spot, which is the cemetery, because my mother is of an age where she knows more people underground than above ground. And then we drive slowly through the cemetery, and then I give her my journal and a pen, and then we stop at various stones, and I go, what do you know about that? And she'll just give you the entire obituary, but of gossipy obituary, which I like, you know.
The bad stuff, too.
Yeah, it's always the best. There's always just a little bit of dirt in there, you know. And so I like that. So Pigza came off of a stone.
Oh.
So
wow.
That's where that came from.
Wow.
I know.
And Rebecca, how do you name your characters, or what would you do with Hercules Mooney?
Well, so I would draw a complete blank with Hercules Mooney, because I stink at spontaneous storytelling.
Yeah.
That is just, woo, not my skill. And, I mean, even I actually feel like kind of a cruddy mom, because my kids would say, especially my younger son, a lot of the time would say, tell me a story. And I would say, let's read one of these pre-written books that we have. That would be really fun for both of us, because I go blank. I don't know what it is. But weirdly, I in Liar and Spy, there's a sister and two brothers, as Megan just said, whose names are Candy, Pigeon, and Safer. And I named them that without having any idea why those were their names. And it was many months before I knew why. I just knew that the names were really appealing, and they sounded to me like they might come from the same set of parents. But I really did not know the story, and I kept thinking in the back of my head, at some point you're going to have to figure out this story, or probably say something about it, because with those kinds of names, I don't know how many of you agree. I guess I would feel some pressure as a writer to say something about the names, having given the kids those names.
Well, even Miranda's name gets explained.
Miranda's name gets explained,
yeah.
But I didn't have to explain it, because that's not that weird a name.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. I explain it for a reason. That's law related. That's from my prior career.
Miranda, right?
That's right. So, anyway, Kate?
That's the only part of Hercules Mooney.
Like Rebecca, I couldn't do anything with it on the spot, but I know I can do something with it if you let me take it back to my little hole in the wall.
Please do. Yeah. Totally.
I mean, it's great. But the only part of writing that's easy for me is names. They pop into my head. And I make sure I always have a notebook to write them down. And I don't know, you know, kids will always say, where do all those strange names in your books come from? The only explanation I have is that I grew up in the South and that there are a lot of strange names down there. I went to school with a boy named General Payne, you know, and I doubt myself at this age because I know how overactive my imagination is. So I called my best friend that I grew up with and it's like, did we go to school with a boy named General Payne or am I making that up? She's like, oh, no, General Payne and his brother Sergeant. So, I mean, it's just like if that gets to you at an early age, I think, you know, it warps your brain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's I love names and I love coming up with names and it's not work. That is all fun. And once you have the name, then you have there's the character, and then for me, it's just following the character, you know. So
how does character follow name for you then? Like, if can you find a character in your writing where the name came first, and then you built character from that?
Well, as soon as I mean, it's simultaneous. Okay. They for me, I don't know about y'all, but as soon as it's the name, then the character's there, and then it's just not being so terrified that you don't continue because, you know, it's following that and doing the work of following that, which is what we're always terrified to do. I don't know if Jack's terrified. Rebecca
I don't
and I
think
are terrified.
Jack's terrified. I don't
no,
know.
No, he doesn't give off a terrified vibe
no.
at all. No. He gives off a very certain vibe. Yeah. What's that like to be certain?
I'm just too insensate to be terrified.
I think all the terror was wrung out of you in childhood.
I don't know.
I wasn't. Yeah, we weren't riding our bikes off the roof into the pool. So, you know, we have leftover terror, I guess, you know.
Now, there's, you know, I mean, it's a challenge. It's certainly a challenge.
Yeah.
But terror.
Hmm.
This seems, is that not an overstatement?
No, not really.
No.
I'm shocked. I think I'd take another field of work.
I constantly think about that, yeah.
Yeah.
You were a lawyer. I mean, that's like, I never had another field of work.
So we have a few minutes before we turn the questions over to the audience. And you've already covered some of the material I was going to ask you about, the kinds of things you read as kids and how it influenced your writing. But what about books that you really didn't like to read at kids when you got, as kids, when you had assignments, things that you kind of groan about? And have you shifted in your reading taste to embrace those kinds of books? Did you like one genre over another?
If it was a book, I liked it when I was a kid. I read without discretion, you know. So,
yeah, I think I'm the same way. I mean, I generally look now, I think, for the same kind of book that I looked for as a kid, which can be in any genre. And I read a lot of, you know, literary fiction, and then I read really anything I feel like reading, I read, because I feel like great readers read all kinds of books, including books for all ages. But what I look for is a character that I can connect with emotionally. And it doesn't have to mean that there's emotion kind of splattered all over the page. You know, a lot of the time it's reserved emotion that I can sense and that every once in a while will surface a little bit. I think that's kind of my favorite kind. But if there's a real opaque screen between me and the sort of the motivation or the emotions, the people I'm reading about, I tend to lose interest if there's nothing to hold on to.
Do you still have the feeling or do you ever have the feeling that you have to finish the book anyway? Or are you able to put a book down if you're not into it?
I have to say, I usually finish the book, whether I really want to or not. I don't know why. You don't, huh? I don't know where that comes from.
What a surprise.
No sense that I'm obligated to, like, finish a book or stay and watch a bad movie.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, like a baseball game during a
horrible blowout. I'm just like, well, there's other things to do.
Yeah. So, I can definitely leave a baseball game.
you see things fizzle, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, how many books are you sent to blurb? You know, and like you start reading them and you're like, okay, character, setting, problem, chasm. You finish it?
Oh, see, you wonder why we're terrified.
Yeah. You don't finish that.
No. So now we're going to turn the question time over to the audience and see if there are any young readers out there who would like to ask our writers questions. And there's someone right here. Yes.
I go back to all those books that I loved when I was a kid and try to figure out how they did it. So Mary Norton, I loved The Borrowers.
Oh, that's good.
And it's just like, how'd she do that, you know? And E.B. White, of course.
Yeah.
You know, I never read Charlotte's Web when I was a kid. That's a longer story about why I didn't. But I read Stuart Little, and I still read E.B. White all the time. Same reason. How did he do this? Trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm doing it for my heart, but I'm also doing it trying to figure out how he made words matter so much. Or he has this wonderful ability to make one word do the work of 10 words, and it's just like, how do you do that? So yeah. I go back to the people that I loved when I was a kid. What about you guys?
It's called Shrunken White, right? But also, the end of Stuart Little, doesn't that still puzzle you?
It does.
Stuart really starts chasing after women with intent.
Right. but it's so, well, although, you know, let's just pretend that Jack didn't say that. But that he's not a mouse in a car chasing after women with no intent. But it's interesting to approach that book, which I loved so much as a kid, as a writer, and to see, I mean, there's parts of it that are just spectacular. And then also you think, why'd you do this and why'd you do that?
Yeah.
Which is instructive and wonderful to take it all apart, you know.
When you look at the Stepstones, you know, like he did, you know, Stuart Little, and I think he learned so much from that, and then he brought it up to Charlotte's Web, and he said, you know, no more of those funny New Yorker endings. You know, and let's just clearly say in the kid zone.
Huh. Okay. More questions? Are only people with question marks on allowed to ask questions?
No,
there we go. Okay.
That was really
great. The blue vest right here.
Like Batman.
Yeah.
My favorite book when I was a kid. There were several favorite books that I had that I kept coming back to. One was William Penn. I can't say his last name because
Dubois.
Thank you, Dubois. The 21 Balloons. I loved that, and I was fascinated by it. And, you know, it's so strange because when Jack had his thing, when he had the visual for Harriet the Spy, Harriet the Spy was critical to me as a kid, and I have never reread it as an adult, and I just did that, like, maybe 6 months ago. And that book is exactly what you said. It's a handbook for how to be a writer.
Yeah.
And so that was, like, that was right at the top, and I would reread that all the time. But it's funny that when I get this question, I never mention Harriet the Spy because it's, like, I think I internalized it to the point where I didn't even think of it as a book, necessarily. It was a how-to, you know?
Have to read the sequel.
Oh, I wouldn't touch the sequel.
No.
I don't know. Oh, should I not say that? I don't know. Maybe the sequel's great. I don't know.
Although,
I never cracked the book. Have you did the sequel?
I have read the sequel, but not for a long time. I also was a big lover of Harriet the Spy, and also A Wrinkle in Time, and also a book that no one reads anymore that I'm trying to bring back. And it was written by Robert Heinlein, who's a science fiction writer.
Which one?
He wrote Red Planet. It's one of his science fiction books for kids. Mm. It's such a good book. It's so exciting, and it has these great characters, and it has this terrific science, and it's amazing. I loved that book.
From the library, or did you own it?
I owned it. I owned the paperback. I can see the cover in my head. But I reread Harriet the Spy last year also, and I really felt like I discovered that that book was actually about becoming a writer.
Yeah, and that was unbeknownst to me.
I didn't know either.
It was not conscious.
And it's so raw. It's so amazing.
It's
but you know what's really good is, have you read Sport?
No, Sport. That's about...
It's about her friend
yeah,
Sport.
No, and that was never on my radar.
I really like that one. I really like Sport. So I'm going to go out and endorse that one.
Okay, all right, okay. And the sequel might be great. I don't know. I've just never tried it.
Another question?
Yes. So it's a question about process, and I'm going to kind of condense and paraphrase what you said. So when I started writing, I started with that 2 pages a day. What does that 2 pages a day look like? What did it look like then, and what does it look like now? And do I still kind of do it the same way? Did I do justice to your question? There's a wonderful collection at the University of Minnesota library. It's called the Curlin Collection, where you can go in and see rough drafts. Have you guys turned your stuff in there?
No,
what's
I
your problem? So. Writers and illustrators of children's books, your rough drafts. And so anybody can go in and look at these things, which is kind of really horrifying for me because it's like somebody looking through my, you know, closet. It's really embarrassing. And if so, but you can see exactly how I work. And I turn my stuff in there because... For the very reason that somebody said to me, I sat next to somebody at a luncheon once who said, I looked at those rough drafts of Winn-Dixie, and I thought to myself, if you're allowed to start this way, then I can write a book. And she did write a book. And that's why it's there, because I think that people have this notion that you look in the mirror and you're supposed to see the word writer on your head. By the same token, they think, if I... am supposed to be a writer, then it should be easy for me. It should come out right when I sit down. And guess what? Unless you're a genius, unless you're a Mozart, it's not going to come out right the first time. And there's one genius every century, and you're probably not it. And I'm not it. So you have to do that work. And that's what you would see if you looked at my 2 pages is in the first draft, you would think I'm a crazy person. And by the second draft, it gets a little bit better. By the third draft, it's starting to cohere. By the fourth draft, it's becoming something resembling a story. By the fifth draft, I kind of understand a little bit about what I'm doing. By the sixth draft, my friends will see it. The seventh draft goes to my editor. And then we start all over because the editor sends a letter that says, you know, what are you doing? I take it apart and start again. And so what you would see even now is still the same as when I started, because each book, what you find from one book to the next is you don't learn how to write a novel. You just learn how to write the novel that you just wrote. And so each novel, it's a learning process all over again. And all you take from one to the next is, I did this once. Maybe I can do it again. But each novel has its own learning curve, don't you think? It's just like,
oh, yeah.
You think, okay, great, now I know how to write a book. No, you know, you don't.
Yeah. So. I actually just got a letter from my editor about the first chunk of the book I'm working on now, which we're not talking about.
You want to talk about that?
No.
Are you terrified?
But I'm terrified. But I sent her a big chunk, and I have this poster in my apartment that says "Work hard and be nice to people," that my editor Wendy liked, and this guy who makes these posters had another one that he had made that it's like the sort of old-fashioned poster press style, and one of the posters that he was selling said, I like it. What is it? So I got her that one, stupidly.
And that's what she said to
so
you.
Yeah, she just sent me a letter about this big chunk of something that I sent her, and she wrote back, I like it. What is it? So,
but she liked it.
I know. That was the good part.
That's something to hold on to.
The second part was the, yeah.
There's a question in the back here.
What was the first
what
part?
What entertains you, did you say?
I usually just say, oh, I'm going to write a book. And then,
because he's terror-free, you know. Yeah.
And then after that, I say, well, what am I going to write a book about? And then that's always an easy question for me, because then I go, I'm going to write about myself. And then, because it's all me all the time. So I think what you should just do is put yourself first and foremost, right in the center of your writing life, and start writing about what you see, what you feel, what you hear, what's inside, what's outside, and before long, poof, you'll be sitting up here talking about process.
That's great advice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Say that again.
That at her school, you get to choose an award for a book, and the book Out of My Mind got
it. Which was written by... I didn't actually write that book out of my mind.
Can you be happy for the person who wrote it?
But I'm happy anyway for her.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually feel... Am I crazy? Is it...
I don't know, Out of My Mind.
Sharon Draper?
Yeah.
It is, right? Oh. Sharon Draper.
A round of applause for Sharon
Draper. Yay!
Any award is a good award, yeah.
Absolutely.
Sharon Draper, sorry she couldn't be here this morning.
There's a question over here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let's start with Jack.
Well, Jack.
On that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes. A lot of my books are autobiographical or semi-autobiographical or just somewhat autobiographical, and a lot of fiction. But frequently I like falling back on a good scene that I know something about. There's something very encouraging about writing that scene, because you kind of have a sense of the size of the room and the thinking and the action that takes place in it. And you can begin to measure how you approach that scene by what really happened and whether you've captured it or not, or whether you're going to distort it one way or the other. You might have a scene that you want to read comic, or you might take that very same scene that happened to you personally and make it a little bit more tragic. So when you realize that you have a scene from real life, then you get to tweak it and distort it, and that's when you're bringing your art to it, and you can measure that at the desk where you are.
Hmm. Yeah, I second that. And in When You Reach Me, I used a lot of sort of setting and a lot of my life in sixth grade, including the apartment where I lived and the school where I went. And I had this 40-minute-a-day job at Subway Sandwiches when I was in sixth grade. Yeah, so Kate, you said you weren't sure if that kid really could have had that name, General...
General Payne.
General Payne.
Yeah, his brother Sergeant. Yes.
Right, and his brother Sergeant.
And their sister Vera, who, you know...
Poor Vera!
They let the theme go at that point,
The thing I had to fact-check with friends was that in sixth grade, so we were 11, we worked at the Subway Sandwiches for our lunch period on Broadway, and we actually were, like, using the meat slicer and making sandwiches, and, you know, which if you saw an 11-year-old using a meat slicer at Subway Sandwiches today, I'm pretty sure someone would call 911, but this was the 70s, and people just thought, hey.
Use a meat slicer.
Nothing. Yeah.
It's not as terrifying as writing a book.
I know.
There you go.
So but there's no actual scene in the book that's like, you know what I mean, that you could track the way, like Jack could actually show you, you know, where he fell and got that bloody nose. And I don't have that close a parallel, but but I still used a lot from my own life and just sort of twisted it and did what I want with it in sort of the way that Jack was saying.
That's right.
That's right.
I like that, you know, that meat slicer. Is that how they created vellum?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. We did sometimes cut the plastic into the meat. That happens.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry to tell you.
Yeah.
Don't point that out.
And, Kate, have you ever vacuumed up a squirrel or had a rat haul in your soup?
Fortunately, we're running out of time, aren't we? So I don't need to talk about vacuuming squirrels. No, I've never, you know, where I see myself in the books is in the emotional truth of it, but I've never put anything in that's happened to me. Absolutely. I've had a pretty boring life, you know.
Lots of reading.
Yeah. You know, I had measles 3 times, which somebody's going to tell me that, you know, you didn't. It's like, yeah, I did, you know, that, but it doesn't really make a story, you know.
So time for one more question here in the front.
Oh.
Who? Who are you talking to? All of us? Yeah. Are you an only child? How unfortunate, you know? Because what I usually say is, and that's your mother sitting next to you, so it doesn't work now, because I go, which of your children do you love the best? But obviously, that's an easy question for you. You love her the best. Yeah. The books for me are like my kids. So I could never pick a favorite. I would say that I love them equally but differently because they're individuals, and I would say they're deeply flawed, but I love them anyway.
That is so watery.
It's watery?
Really?
What, can you pick a favorite?
Yes, of course you can.
You can pick a favorite?
Come on. Tell
us
the truth.
No, there is no truth. That's the truth. That's the truth.
Go ahead.
What's your favorite?
That kind of...
Make Jack go. What's your favorite?
The latest book.
that's a publicity answer.
It's for sale right now.
I might be watering.
Come on, I read it off the back of one of yours. But
okay, what about Rebecca? Favorite?
I mean, I guess mine is anything but the one I'm working on now. Which is the opposite of what I often hear, which is the one I'm working on now.
Really? People
yeah,
will say that.
I have heard that a lot. That's the one I'm in love
that's
with right now.
That's the
publicity answer.
What?
Yes, that's the publicity answer. You're right.
Well, so. You can't buy the book that Rebecca is working on now,
no.
But you can buy lots of other books by these writers in the Gordon Chapel, which is right through here as you exit. So I want to take a moment to thank everyone for being here in our audience and on our panel, and encourage you all to head over to the book sale and book signing.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for being
thank
here.
You.
Thank you for taking care of us in here.